We continue with our discussion on healing. And the question is asked, what is my morning routine? And my morning routine, are you still running here? I touched this thing.
That's fine.
That's just it.
It's still running.
Okay. Basically, I get up at 4 o'clock and I feed the dog and then I shower and prepare myself and then I will either one or two alternatives, either take the dog for a walk and walk around our 3-mile perimeter of our property, or I will answer email. And if I open the email too quickly, I will have a dozen emails sitting there, and then you have to go boom, 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 you know, to answer them all. So when I finally get out to take my walk with the dog, we have a real nice walk, and I am affirming, I live in my ideal spirit, mind, and body. I affirm, I like me, I am divine order, I am peace. I like me, I am divine order, I am peace. I like me, I am divine order, I am peace. And I like me is obvious. You know, that's a good thing to say.
Okay.
I like me, I am divine order, I am peace. I like me is obvious, I am divine order. That should be obvious too. That is our reality. And I am peace is the big, really clicker. It's the word that really moves us into where we want to go. Okay? Then, after that, I come back and it's time for breakfast. And I have breakfast with my staff. And we have 3 meals a day at our house. And the first meal is at 8 a.m. and noon and at 6. And so they know how to plan on it. I know how to plan on it. Everybody knows how to plan on it. So at 8 a.m., before I go up to the house after my walk, I usually make 5 talks on the internet. And I take my recorder here, and I'll take a thought for today. I'll write down titles, you know, and titles of talks that I want to give. And then I'll give a talk. This is Dr. Herbert L. Byerly, Dean of the University of Healing, here in Capital, California, with Thought for Today. Can you imagine why anyone would ever get up in the morning? This is our thought for today. Can you imagine why anyone would ever get up in the morning? Why would anyone get up in the morning? Because it's morning. But I get up in the morning because it's a chance for me to live a day of happiness, fulfillment, health, harmony, peace, and so forth. And then I go on into my talk, you know. And then I go into the second talk, instant illumination. The talk is from 5 minutes to 10 minutes. Then I go into the next talk, which is the absolute philosopher, which could deal with the deeper qualities of thinking. And then I go into Mr. Candle. And Mr. Candle, hello, good evening, good evening, good evening. It's morning, you know. Boys and girls, this is Mr. Candle sitting on your bedside table telling you stories of children from around the world. Then I tell some stories. And then I have another one, which I've been using more regularly now, Bible stories. And I will take a story from the Bible, and I will take the story that is given, and then I will point out what was the intention of that story, which every minister has done from the past 2,000 years. But I have fun. And then I go up and have breakfast, and then they all listen to the talks that I've given. And then after that, then we sit and discuss it and talk about the things that are important to them. And then I go back to my office, and I even take another walk around the property, because I like doing that. And I get back to my house, the Hermitage, and it's one room about this size here, pretty much here. A little bit bigger perhaps, but it has a little kitchen area and a bathroom and a little living area with my bed on one side and the davenport and stuff on the other. And then my desk and closet and what have you. So it's quite nice. And So I go on about my daily activities of answering more email, answering letters. I have tons of letters that come in that have to be answered, you know, personally. And then whenever the girls have a letter that is difficult to answer, they give to me. And so I take care of that. And next time, you know, it's lunch, you know. And so it's time to go up and eat lunch and be with the group. And then after lunch, maybe get another walk in around the property. You know. Nice time saying, I like me. It takes an hour to take the walk around the property. And I like me. And then I come back. And then sometimes I'll take a nap for 20 minutes. And then after that, go on with the writing or the work or the preparation of seminars from around the world. And at supper time, you know. Actually, the puppy's supper time at 4 o'clock. He eats at 4 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. 2 cups of food at each meal. And he looks just fantastic. And so sometimes I'll take the tractor and go out and grade the roads and organize the rain wherever it is washed and ditched and stuff. And then sometimes I'll just go out and take my clippers and go walking on the path and clip off the edges where the branches want to grow onto the path. And then the next trip I make, I'll pick up the clippings that I made. One time I got the clippers in my hand, the next time I have nothing except to pick up the branches and pick them up. And it's a very lovely arrangement. And then at supper time, we gather together, have a nice meal. Oh, by the way, at breakfast, before we eat our breakfast, we all stand and we have an om together. And we say, om, 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 om. And everybody enjoys it. Then after the om, we have I like me, concluded with I am peace. And then it is concluded with a hug and a kiss for everybody, right on their schnooker, you know. And everybody loves it. And I have one 89-year-old lady there who thinks it's just the greatest thing in the world to be hugged, you know, and especially by me, because she has been having a little difficulty, and I ripple my fingers up and down her spine. And of course, it's right, it's good, it's nice, you know. Can't blame her. Nobody does it to me, though. I have to train them. But then we have a chat about whatever they want to talk about, and whatever things come to their mind. And then after that, I take the dog and go to bed. At least I go down to my house, or maybe I read for the evening. And then they finish cleaning up the house and get ready for their evening, too, for whatever they want to do. But that is the basic pattern. Doesn't sound very exciting. But it's very fulfilling, very rewarding. And I spend a third of my year and route going various places here, Farmington, New Mexico, to Canada, to Oregon, to New York, to Delaware, to you name it, and Europe and London and Africa and stuff. And you know, that does take a lot of time, but I have a lot of fun. So I put everything onto the internet. I don't try to transcribe any of the talks or any of those things. It's just too much to do, you know. And I let people listen to what they want, and then they have it. So it makes a very nice arrangement. Any other question about my daily activity?
Thank you.
So it's very nice. And you had a thought that you wanted to present?
Several thoughts, but following through with this one, do we understand that you have monks and students on your property as well?
I have what?
Monks and students that live on the property at Campo.
I have monks and what's the other word?
Students.
Students. Basically, I don't have students living on the property. Everyone who lives on the property is a monk. And it's a monk for convenience for them and for us. We don't pay them anything. We feed them, we house them, we clothe them, we take care of their medical expenses, you know, and things like that. But then they spend from 4 to 6 hours a day working on uni work. 4 to 6 hours a day working on uni work, and they have tried to promote me into thinking that washing dishes, cooking food, and so forth is uni work. And I said, no, that's not uni work. I said, if you had a job and you worked 6 to 8 hours on your job and then you came home, you'd make your own dishes and you'd cook your own food and you'd wash your own clothes and do all those things on your own time. So I figure if you work 4 to 6 hours for the uni, which is not a heck of a lot, you can don't consider the other stuff uni work, because they will sometimes try to move the cooking into the 4 to 6 hours and you get virtually nothing out of them. But most of them are dedicated, diligent, capable, responsible people, and over the years there have been a few who didn't want to do what they were asked to do, and so I told them, okay, don't. And I gave them other things. They didn't do it. They didn't do it. They didn't do it. So then I stopped giving them things to do, and they had nothing to do. And so they said, can I have something to do? I said, no, I have nothing for you to do. You have refused everything I've given you to do, so I have nothing for you to do. And they say, well, I can't stay here if I'm not going to do anything. I said, that's up to you, you know. And then they leave. But if you're going to work for a corporation, you do what you're asked to do. If you are a monk, of all things, you have taken the vow of self-dedication, and no money and things like that, and you do what you're asked to do, and basically they do what they're asked to do, and they do it very nicely with a lot of love, and it's fun. I point out the other to you because there are always the rebels who miss the point, you know. And then we have had the 3-month School of the Master seminar on campus. We've had a number of them recently. 2000 we had one. And we had 18 people there for 3 months doing nothing but meditating and listening to my program and courses and doing what they were assigned to do, working on their meditation paths. And when they left, they were the most gorgeous people you ever want to see in your life. Sensitive, loving, caring, brown as bears, because they're all running around naked, and just working hard and just enjoying themselves and eating good foods, and everything was what I chose. They had no decision on anything. They just ate it. And they learned non-possession. They learned to be untouched. You see, I would come to the table and I'd say, okay, and I'd say like this, we are not going to do this. That means, until I change the order, this is what we're not going to do. We are not going to use utensils to eat with. And so they thought, how do you eat soup without utensils? Because you can't use the bowl as a utensil to put it up to your lips. You have to pick it up with your fingers. Everything had to be eaten with your fingers. And so they ate with their fingers. And after a week of it, they were thrilled with it. They thought there was nothing more wonderful than eating with your fingers, especially when they didn't have to eat soup. But the soup, they figured out ways to do it too. And they did that for a long time, and it was just wonderful. And they all slept in the living room of the monastery, which is maybe about as big as this whole part of the house here, you know. And all feet to feet, you know, and no blankets, no nothing, just on the carpet, you know, and they slept there for 3 solid months. And they slept there like angels. When nighttime came, they were dead tired. They were ready for sleep. And when we did our OM in the morning, they were ready for that. And they just were so fantastic. And then I gave them other challenging experiences too, because if they use the bathroom, they were told to open the door when they come out and leave it open, so people would know it's there. They don't have to knock on it. Is anybody in there? Hey, where are you? And I say, leave the door open when you come out. And I said, after a number of people didn't, I said, okay, the next person who closes the door when they come out, I'm going to take the doors off the hinges. Mm-hmm. And so I took all the bathroom doors off the hinges. And so then they had to use the bathrooms without the doors on. And nobody's peeking and nobody cares anyhow. But it was a new experience for them. Then they we're ready for another experience. And I said, all right, no toilet paper. You have to rinse yourself with the water, you know, and with whatever, but no toilet paper. So after a week of not using toilet paper, they thought that was the most gentle thing they had ever done in their life to their bottom. Because, you know, their bottom was touched with their gentle hands and water, and they were clean, and they'd wash their hands after they were done, and it was just so wonderful for them, you know. And it was great. Then another little challenge they had, I gave them towels like this. I still use it. It's one of these chamois that you use for sports chamois, their name for it. And it's very nice. And I use it now, and I take it with me. I use it at your house. I take it with me wherever I go, because after I'm done with it, I rinse it out four times, you know, on both sides, and then wring it out and put it in its container. And when I go someplace, then I have my towel, my chamois. And it's so gentle on the skin, it's so nice to use. Well, I had a rule after the first day there that every sink had to be wiped absolutely clear of any drop of water whenever anyone got done using it. So the next person who came in had a dropless sink, you know. And that was tough. That was tough. Because the silly people didn't turn the handle off tight on the sink and so it would drip. And they were responsible. That meant that everybody had to go in and wipe that sink. Everybody. And if the toilets were left unsanitary or dirty in any way, everybody had to go in and wash that toilet. And so they soon learned to do it very carefully and turn the handle off completely and then wipe their towel under the faucet because there might be a drop hanging there and take it off. It's just discipline, self-discipline. When they left, they were magic people, because they get all that rebellion out of their system, all that anger out of their system, all the unhappiness, and they started living a very peaceful, gentle, happy life, and fulfilling too. And one man there, he owned a business in Switzerland, still does, and very successful, that makes $8-10 million a year. You know, that's a cheap little job. And so after he had been with us for the program, he went back to his business, and he said to his board of directors, okay, our budget for next year is going to be $8 million more than it was the past year. Just arbitrarily, $8 million more. And so they had $8 million more than last year come in. And so the next time he put it up to double and triple. And you know, the company is now worth billions. And all because he attended the school of the master and learned self-discipline and learned to speak his word and have results happen. Ah, you know. And he did. He said to his board of directors, this is what we're bringing in next year. And it's going to be this many million dollars more than it was last year. And it's fantastic. And, of course, thousands of other things happened too. But these are things that took place. They really learned. Then each was given a path, a piece of land, and they were told to make a path on that land. There's no path there. There might have been the tilt of the land that laid itself out for a path, but they had to get the bushes out of the way. And they were not allowed to use any mechanically or humanly touched a device to establish the path. They could use hoes and rakes and things like that, but they couldn't use glass, you know, because sometimes the glass along the edge they wanted to make shiny and stuff, you know. The girls were very creative. And so I said, no, you can't do that. You got to just use what's natural, what's laying here and what's there. And they their paths are still there. How many years ago is that now? 6 years? And it's still just gorgeous. Some has grown over a little bit, and we have trimmed in because we had to cut out some of the dead wood here and there, but it's still beautiful. I walked many of the paths, and one guy, the rich guy, there were two of them. There's Herbert and Stefan, And Stefan is a normal guy, a successful fellow. And he had his path in the valley. And I told him, you just put the path in here wherever you want it to go. And it goes right behind these big rocks and beautiful. So what does he do? He puts it right at the base of the valley. Right where any water comes, the trees grow. You got to cut them down constantly. Instead of going up the hill a little bit and making the path along the edge of the hill, like they do in Switzerland, you know, or like they do anyplace else. But he went on the bottom. So his was a continually changing path. Herbert, on the other hand, he had this upper path. And he made this path. And along the path, he put down every storybook that he ever had. The never-ending story where you look at the mirror at the end, you know, and he had that on a piece of stick, a mirror. That wasn't acceptable. But he had that. Then he had mazes that he made with beautiful stones and big mazes. And then he had a sundial, and he had a circle in which he put all of the names of all of the participants for the seminar. And a very industrious, as you can see, and creative fellow. And he did his work, and he got it all done. And he says, Herb, what can I do now? And I said, continue. And so he did. He bumped into other people, so he had to turn. So the other people had their paths, and so he turned. And where he turned, it went straight up the mountain. Well, instead of doing like they do in Switzerland with Serpentine Road, he made it straight up the mountain. And I thought, oh my goodness sakes. And because everybody was so fit and so healthy, that when we took our walks around everybody's paths, you know, if nothing to climb right up, just climb right. Half of them were barefoot, you know, as well. And they just loved it. They just thought it was the greatest thing on earth. But see, all these paths, those were, that's just two, but all the paths were just glorious. And we had an Om path, and we had people who were etching out of stone the Om on there. That was Heinz from Australia, rather New Zealand. And he just loves it. And he's on the phone to me maybe once a week. But these people, their lives just gathered in speed because they learned self-discipline. They learned to be untouched. They learned they could live absolutely naked for 3 months. And the weather was absolutely perfect those 3 months, you know, naturally. And what good consciousness they had. I don't know what it was outside of where we were, but our 100 acres were just fabulous. And they did their chores, but I gave them another test, which I think is interesting for you to have. I don't know if you could, I don't know, are these people any good? Do you think they have the ability to perceive this?
Try it out.
I'll try it out. How many of you can say, I'm number one. Huh? None of you?
I'm number one.
Say it. I'm number one.
I'm number one.
Okay. You all said it? Okay. Now, how can you say, I'm number one, and believe you're number one? How can you say, I am the only person on the face of the earth? Can you say that? I am the only person on the face of the earth. Let's say it again. I am the only person on the face of the earth. So, if I'm the only person on the face of the earth, you see, I have no problem with walking right through this here, because there's nobody here. No, there's nobody here. Can you feel that way? Can you think that way, that there's nobody there? There's nobody here? You're not sitting next to anybody. You're sitting here alone. And with me. Of course, I have me in that because you're my friend. You're the only person on the face of the earth. I'm just a thing, you know. And so, other people sitting next to you? Throw your arms out. Slam them hard. Chicken. But you see, that's what we're afraid of. We're afraid of being the only person on the face of the earth. Now, I said to the group, I said, you are the only person on the face of the earth. You are the only person on the face of the earth.
I am the only person on the face of this earth.
Yeah, you, each of you. Now, each of you are the only person on the face of the earth. And then I would say, I'm sitting at the table. And they are too. And I said, I'd like a glass of water. Now, the only person on the face of the earth gets up and gives me a glass of water. So I have 18 glasses of water. And they come and flux down right in front of me. 18 glasses of water. And some of them stop for the other people's glasses, you know, and are careful of them. And I say, hey, what are you cautious about there? You know, why are you so cautious? And they say, well, yep. You know, they couldn't say it because they're the only person on the face of the earth. That was the hardest lesson for all of them to learn. And many of them didn't learn it. And the reason they didn't learn it was because they could not conceive of other people not being there. They would go out the door. And instead of closing the door behind them like they're supposed to, they didn't close it because somebody was standing right there behind them. But you're supposed to close that door because there's nobody behind you. Now, can you do that? That's tough. That's real tough because you're taught courtesy. You're taught, they'll kick my butt if I close the door right in their face. It's not very nice, you know. Well, they shouldn't be walking so close. But the thing is, they're not there. They're not there. And can you, you know, conceive of yourself as the only person on the face of the earth and others are there or not there as you choose? Okay, now, let's create the other people there. I didn't have them do this. But let's have them create the other people there. You are my creation. You are my creation. You have no life of your own. You have only the life that I give you. You have only the existence that I say you have, or that you say I have. If you're number one and you're the only person on earth, then whoever you create. Now, do you create somebody following you out the door? If you do, then open it for them. But if you create nobody following you out, you know, I created you all, just sit down, I'm doing my thing, you know. And I have created you, and you are my creation. Can you conceive of something like that? That is very difficult. You see, that, going with the next point, is one of the very necessary things to the next point. That saying, I am number one, and saying I'm the only person on the face of the earth, goes with the next point, which is, I am a
Master.
Oh, you're so good. I am a master. Yeah. I am a master. Now, what does it mean to be a master? It means that you are absolutely blind to anything other than yourself. A master only sees, yes, Richard?
Perfection.
Another master. A master only sees another master. A master does not have the vision to see anything but himself, itself. A master can only see another master. Now, if you are a loving person, you only see loving people around you. And if you see other kind of people, you're not a loving person. You say you're a loving person, ha 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 ha, but you're really not. You see, if you are a joyful person, then you see joyful people around you. If you are an architect, who do you associate with? Other architects, you know? And if you're a slum bum, you know, if you're down in the tavern all the time, who do you associate with? Other slum bums down the tavern. That's neither good nor bad. That's just who you are. Now, who are you? Who are you? Are you a mother? If you are a mother, then you have children. Now, how are your children? Oh, no, how are your children? My children are a reflection of myself. I am a master. I am unconditional love. My children are unconditional love. I am peace. My children are peace. Yes, yes, yes. Hey, yes, 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 yes. All of you. That's what our children are. Our children are unconditional love. Our children are peace. Our children are abundant. Our children are independently wealthy. Our children are magnificent because that's what we are. And they're our reflection. See, that's what a master is. Now, you don't go around calling yourself a master. You go around being a master. And if you are a master, then you never have your feelings hurt. You never have yourself feeling that you're being misunderstood or not appreciated. You never have anything. And if you ever have the thought go through your mind that you're being misunderstood or that you're sorry for yourself or something, stop it instantly and go and hug the person that makes you feel that way or that made you feel that way. And get it out of your system right away, because then it's over with. But you let that fester in you, and it takes you like this here on your master level, you know, just brings you down and brings you down and brings you down. Now you see people as a master like this. And then now you see people as a master like this. Now you see people as a master who are touched by what other people do and who are upset and who are unhappy, you know. And now you see people, all masters are drunks, you know. And then now all masters are murderers and what have you, and all terrible things. Now, these things I'm saying, these things over the 3 months were taught in the School of the Master, were taught in this wonderful program. And these people who came away from there are absolutely exquisite. Now, these people went to the doctor, and the doctor says, do, and you're okay. But the doctor must also say, that is all you know. That is all you know how to do. This is what you're supposed to do. That's all you know how to do. You don't know how to do anything else. But if they go home and do their own thing and fall back into all the old patterns that they used to have, all of their 3 months in the School of Mastership were just 3 months of absolute pleasure in the sun. Whereas it could have been 3 months of absolute illumination in the sun. Now, I talked to you, and what we said was, these are some good ideas. And you said, yes. And I said, all right, now do it. Now, if you do it, then whatever your dreams were, your dream of that fantastic man, hey, those fantastic kids, that fantastic house, that fantastic, are yours. But if you don't do it, they're not yours. Because you have not done what you said you were going to do. Now, if none of you here are sick, of course, but if any of you were sick and you came to me and asked me for a treatment, I would give you a treatment, pow, 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 you know, and I'd say, you're home perfect, you're home perfect, you're home perfect. Now, recognize this about yourself, recognize it, claim it, enjoy it, be it. Yeah, you can't knock down an angel. Recognize it, control it, and be it. And then, if you go home and you continue being the same sad sack you were before, there's no healing. There's no change in your life. There's no change in anything. Now, you, do you have any children?
No.
Okay. Now, when you go home, what are you going to see your children doing? Just generality. They're whole and perfect. They're fantastic. They're unconditionally loving. You know, they're the most fabulous children in the whole world, the whole neighborhood. All the neighborhood mothers come over and say, can't you train my children too? You know, right?
Right.
Okay, now, got that out. So, now, when she goes home, if she sees any of her little monsters do any little brat things, who's in trouble? She is. If she goes home and she sees every one of her little angels being unconditionally loving, being gentle, kind, sweet, everything good and beautiful. Who's doing this? She is. It's her creation. Her kids cannot be anything other than what she expects of them. If her kids want to be something other than what she expects of them, something what she has created them being, they will not be in her life. You know? If she has any kids that wants to be monsters and wants to be terribly hateful children, and her husband is the same way, then the husband and those children would leave, and she would keep the good ones. Now, you laugh, but it's true. That's true. You say, I'm merely saying that to show you that that's how it would change. It would change in some way like that. Or if she is an unconditionally loving lady and she creates a world of unconditionally loving beings, then what would happen? All of her children would be unconditionally loving beings. How are your children? I wish you'd speak up and I could hear you.
Unconditionally loving beings.
I'm sorry, again.
Unconditional loving beings.
Thank you very much, microphones. I know I'll tune up your volume a little more here. Unconditional loving beings. Now, what does it mean to be an unconditional loving being? For instance, you have a daughter?
Yes.
How is she an unconditional loving being? What's her name?
Vanessa.
Fernanda.
Vanessa.
Vanessa. Vanessa. Ah, yes. I have a beautiful Vanessa in my mind. She's in Switzerland. She came up from the Cameroon, and she's a gorgeous girl. Okay, now, Vanessa, how is she unconditionally loving? Just one act.
She loves and adores her mother.
That's that, please?
She loves and adores her mother.
I don't think that's such a compliment. No, no. How is she an unconditionally loving being? She came to me and she said, Mom, do me a favor. Go in the living room and watch TV. I will do the dishes and put the things away. Okay? And you say, Vanessa, you are an unconditionally loving girl. Oh, you are so sweet. Thank you. Now, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But you see, not that she loves her mother. I mean, because can you create anybody, man, woman, or child in your world who doesn't love you? No. Because you're number one. You see, and what's your son's name?
Stephen.
Yeah, that's a good name, huh? Okay, Stephen. How old is Stephen?
How old is he?
Yeah.
He's
22. Mm-hmm. That's about time. Okay, Stephen. You're Stephen, though. Stephen, tell me, what is the most wonderful thing that your mother ever taught you about yourself? Stephen, tell me, what's the most wonderful thing that your mother taught you about yourself?
That I'm caring and thoughtful.
What's that?
That I'm caring and thoughtful.
That I'm sharing and thoughtful.
Caring
and thoughtful. No, that's good. But
that I can be anything I
want
to be.
Hey, now you're talking. That I can be anything I want to be. That I can be anything I want to be. Now, do you believe your mother when she said that?
Yes.
Why do you believe it? I believe it because that's what she does. Well, now, why do you believe it, Stephen?
Because that's what my mother does.
Yes. But can you see? Can you see how it works?
Yes.
And can you see that's the truth? Now, is Stephen a supercalifragilisticexpialidocious boy?
Yes.
You hesitated, and he who hesitates is lost. Don't do that. Instantly know this as truth about them. Now, I can tell you, what's your first name?
Rochelle?
Ah, yes. One of my best students married Rochelle. She's a super girl up in Santa Clara, California, where they have a vineyard, a ranch, they raise grapes. And she has a daughter, Bailey. Beautiful. Oh, what a talented woman. Ah, I can see where that name comes by. Okay, now, Rochelle,
yes.
Why do you think that you are such a desirable woman?
Because I am.
That's easy to say, but why do you think you're such a... if I were to say, Rochelle, what do you find so desirable about me? And don't think of me as me, think of me as me. You know, just, why? What do you think is so desirable about me? Huh?
because you know who you are.
Wow! Isn't that a compliment? Isn't that a beautiful statement? Wouldn't you like to have someone say that about you?
Definitely.
Is that true about you?
Yes.
And that's why you said it about me, because that's who you are and you saw it in me.
Right.
How cool. Okay. Now, this is true. But you see, we have to play the game. And when we play the game, Vanessa is the most unconditionally loving child that you could ever imagine. And give her the opportunity. Thank Vanessa for picking up the little cricket off the floor instead of stomping on it, you know. Thank Vanessa for opening the door for you when you can. Thank you, Vanessa. Oh, that's so nice that you opened the door for me. I've got this armload of groceries. Thank you, Vanessa. And she'll say, Mom, you don't have to go overboard. And you say, well, I am just so happy. I got the greatest family in the world, the neatest family in the world, the super family. Mom. And you say, Vanessa, if you would open your eyes, you'd see that that's true. Just look at your brother. Isn't he fantastic? Mom, I know things about him. No, Vanessa. He's fantastic. And Vanessa, anything you know about your brother is good and very good. If anything you think you know about your brother is not good, don't say it to a soul. Not to me or anybody else. Because all I know about your brother is that he is the greatest and most wonderful guy on the face of the earth, and that's all I will accept about him. That's all I will hear about him from anybody, and that's all that you know about him. Okay, Mom, I'll play the game with you. But you see, this is good. This is good. And if they can say, I'll play the game with you, then they know it's a game, and they know that it's just something that you do that way, which is good, which is beautiful. Now, in the School of the Master, we played games. We played lots of games. I gave each one of them a guitar, a good guitar. It cost me about $900 each. You know, that's a couple bucks for a guitar. And this was back in 2000, you know. And I gave them a stand, and I gave them a tuning device here, and I gave them a set of music, and I gave them everything. And I said, I want each one of you to practice on this guitar 1/2 hour every day. Just 1/2 hour every day. And so when you leave here, I want you to play more than Ode to Joy. And so, do you know, only 3 of them ended up playing more than Ode to Joy. Some of them did not practice. What foolish, foolish people. Because here they had this 3-month program. They could have spent 3 months in practicing on their guitar. You know what would happen in 3 months? They would have become quite competent mechanically, if not professionally, or what's the other word? Beneficially playing it lovely. But then, now, do you know what happened to those who played it properly and did the lesson? One was Irene. And she's a nurse. And she goes around to people who are getting ready to move on. And she makes the house calls to these people. And as she makes the house call, she takes her guitar along and she sings to them. And those people say, oh, you're the first person who ever cared enough about me to sing right to my face and sing right in my presence and have a guitar here and everything. Wow! You know? Okay. Then, she bought herself a red nose, and she put it on, and she came in to visit him. She'd stick her head around the corner, hi, and step back, and they said, who's that? Oh, hi, how you doing? They said, I'm dying, and you come in here with a red nose on your face, trying to make it fun. Then, well, what kind of person are you? Don't you realize how serious this is, how terrible? And she says, oh, you poor soul. I realize how serious it is and how terrible it is. But hey, if you want to die, go ahead and die. But if you want to live, then I'm here. And so we're going to have fun together. We're going to have fun where we live. And she says, all right, now if you think this nose is silly, wait till you see me next week, you know, or 2 days later when she got back. So she came back with clown hair and a clown hat and a clown tie. And then she went to clown school. Now she's going to clown school, learning how to be a real clown, you know. And she wants to really do a good job. But you see, this is the beauty. She attended our program. She attended the course and learned how to self-discipline herself. And she is just fantastic. And she had an aged mother. You know how mothers are. And they raised you by themselves. The husband left early in their life when the children were young. And the mother was just sort of a, yeah, I raised your kids, I did everything, I'm doing, you know. And she's just a real bitch. And so they got upset with her. And the kids didn't have anything to do with her. And I told Irene, I said, Irene, you, and I went to visit Lydia. And she was living in a nursing home. Not a nursing home, but I mean assisted care home. And I went to visit her with Irene. And on the way in, I stopped at the flower bed as we came in and picked a rose just for her. Nice, big, beautiful rose. And I brought it in and I gave it to her. And she said, you stole that rose. You stole that rose from my garden out in front, you know. And I said, well, I couldn't have stole it for anyone more beautiful than you are, you know. And so then I had Irene work with her, and I had Irene take, she hated her kids because they didn't come and see her. And of course, who would want to come and see somebody who hates you, you know. So I said, Lydia, I said, you are a sweet little lady. She said, yes, I am. And I said, now what are these puppy dogs doing sitting here on the back of your bed, you know, back in the corner of the room? She says, I don't know, somebody gave them to me. So I said, okay, now here's four puppy dogs. It's only your four children. It's going to be your two sons and your two daughters. And you're going to take them and you're going to hold them in your arms. You're going to snuggle them every night and say, I love you to each one, just as your child. And say, good night, happy dreams. Every night you're going to do this. You're going to do this. You know, I ordered her. And so she had to have that translated from English to German because she didn't speak English. And Irene translated very nicely. So we were with her a good half hour, and I was teaching her to hold the puppies and to talk to the puppies and to call them her children. And she started doing that. Irene would come to visit her, and she'd have the children in the right place. And she'd be talking to them and stuff. And then she got to the point where she needed more than assisted care, and she went into a nursing home. And in this nursing home, it had many wards, and there was maybe about 10 or 12 people on her ward. So she was not a very happy lady, and Irene didn't like to go to visit her. And I said, Irene, I commend you, or suggest to you, or direct you to go visit your mother every morning before you go to work for half an hour, and just stand at the foot of her bed. If she's sleeping, that's fine. If she's awake, that's fine. And say, Mom, you're wonderful. Mom, you're the greatest. And then remember all the nice things that she did as you were growing up. And if you can't find them, make them up. And say all the beautiful things about your mom. Mom, you're fantastic. Mom, you're glorious. Mom, you're this. She did that for one solid month. And she continued it for 3 months. But for 1 month, and at the end of 1 month, her mother changed her attitude about Irene, or Irene changed her attitude about her mother, you know. And because she had this change of attitude, her mother became the sweetest, most gentle, loving person you could ever imagine. And there was an old buck there who was in his 80s, just like the mother was in her 80s, and he was a operatic singer. And so he loved to sing to the mother. He'd sing these operatic songs to her. So I would go in and be visiting with him whenever I'd come to Europe. And I'd sing the operatic songs with them, and the whole group would be singing the operatic songs. And so one day, she was talking to her boyfriend in the living room, and Irene and I came in, and Irene stood there for a minute before she walked in, and she listened. And her mother said to her boyfriend, and you know, my daughter is a minister, and she can marry us if we want to get married. This guy, you know, and she never thought of marrying or thought of doing anything all of her life, you know, after her husband had walked out. And what a change. Yeah, would you say a healing had taken place there? My goodness. Would you say many more healings had taken place? Yes. And beautiful. and beautiful. You see, this is what we are all about. We are the creators of our world. Irene opened up her heart. She opened up her life. She opened up herself. And she is so happy. She is so content. She is so fulfilled. It's really a rewarding thing to be with her. But she went to the school of the master. She made her own special path. And she, it's a Sherry's dream come true. She is a share. I'm a sharer, and she's a sharee. And the Sherry's dream would come true. So she has all these beautiful things. And people who walk along her path instantly feel uplifted and feel enlightened because she has brought that forth into her path. Now, you guys, you bring forth into your life exactly who you are. And if you have happy people surrounding you, and let's certainly know you do, that's because you're a master and you're reflecting that happiness in all the people that you're creating. Now, do you want to do that? Yes, of course. Do you want to be the master yourself? Yes, of course. Can you do this? Yes, of course. Why aren't you doing it?
I am.
You are doing it. Richard does it all the time. I walk into Richard's house, I say, Richard, got a good laugh? He says, yes, here's a shield. He gets them in by the scads, and he shares them. But, you see, that's the wonderful thing. That's the wonderful thing. I was telling someone about this lady that I was visiting, and we went to visit her. She's our student. We went to visit her mother. She's 97, and she's in a rest home. And she's a happy lady, and I talked to her. She'd come to my seminars often, and then, of course, she got so she wasn't coming anymore. But I said, you know, Eleonora, I said, how are you doing, Eleonora? And she's out of Russia and so forth, just a fabulous girl. And I'm fine. Nice to see you, her. Nice to see you, Dr. Barley. She called me both. And she said, I'm still saying I'm home perfect. She said, I'm saying that. And then I had one of our students who was having some deep problems. I said, all right, now you go and give her a big hug and snuggle and show her what laughter is all about. So, she went up to Eleonora and she picked up this slim, trim, beautiful doll that's laying there in this bed in this gorgeous room with a view of the Swiss Alps and a view, everything's marvelous. And she picked her up and she says, Eleonora, I love you, you're wonderful, you're wonderful, wonderful. And then she said, Eleonora, do you know how to laugh? And she started laughing. And she laughed for 5 minutes with Eleonora. And Eleonora said, do you know, I can feel my tummy now. I haven't felt my tummy for months now. You know, I can feel my tummy, I can feel my body, I can feel myself. She got her laughing. Now, that's unfair stuff. That's unfair, because she didn't go back. She didn't go back and work with her on laughter. Her own daughter, who was with her, and who was going out sailing with her boyfriend on their yacht that afternoon and didn't have time to come back, and then she was going back up to Czechoslovakia where they have a home, and then down to the Mediterranean where they have another sailboat and so on. I mean, you know, I deal with a lot of affluent people. they have nice lives. But anyhow, I didn't tell her, go visit your mom and go snuggle her and huggle her and laugh with her and get her going in this healing attitude, in this healing experience. The healing attitude, the healing atmosphere of wonderful healing. You see, when you laugh, you've all heard of Norman Cousins. Norman Cousins wrote a book on laughter, healed his cancer experience, and a very good book. If you haven't read it, you should read it, because it works in every area of your life. And he was very wealthy. He had many high positions, and then he got this life-threatening cancer, and the doctors just said, you know, you just go and write your will and be ready to go. So he says, to hell with that. And so he went across the street from the hospital, he rented a suite of rooms, and he hired a suite of nurses around the clock to be with him, and every person who came to visit him had to bring a joke and tell a joke to him. And he saw every Laurel and Hardy movie, every funny movie that existed, and he laughed and he laughed, and within a very short within a very short time, he no longer had the problem.
Wow,
he was fully healed, and he went on to become the president of the Stanford University Medical Association, and served for many years and do many wonderful things. But you see, he laughed. He laughed. And laughter helped him to get rid of that experience that he had, because every illness is a mental illness. Every problem that we experience is a mental problem. And if we can laugh about our own problems, if we can laugh about our own life, we can laugh about those things that disturb us, then they go away. And it's not that they go away. It's that the laughter brings out in us the wholeness that we are. I return to my original purity and integrity, which is not correct. I return in thought to my original purity and integrity. I never left my original purity and integrity. I thought I did. I thought that I was not whole and perfect. I thought these things, but that's not real. That's not real. I have experienced in my newspaper work, I've owned and published newspapers across the United States, and in my newspaper work, I was a photographer and a journalistic photographer, you know, a photojournalist, and things like that, among other things. And so I would take my camera, you know, and go and photograph the scenes that the police would call, and they say, "Fire!" And there I am, over at the fire. And I'm taking pictures of the fire, and it's a beautiful picture. I got good pictures, the house burning down and everything, you know. And I go around the back of the building, and I take pictures back there. And there's a mother looking out the window. "Take my baby, take my baby!" She throws her baby at me, and I got the camera in one hand and the empty hand over here, so I grab the kid. I should have dropped the camera, you know, but I mean, I'm professional. I don't throw my tools away, you know. So I grabbed the kid, and I held on to him, and I continued taking pictures and went around the front, and I told the fireman, I said, "Here, there's a lady." Yeah, I went around right away. I said, "There's a lady upstairs. She needs to jump out, get the net for her, you know, and this is her kid." And I gave the fireman the kid, and I went on taking pictures. You say, "Well, Herb, how could you be so blasé about it?" Well, when you're a professional in your business, you are blasé. If you're not blasé, you are useless. If you are a doctor, if you are a surgeon, and you have to operate on your son's brain to save his life, and you can't do it because it's your son, you are not a surgeon. You are not a professional. They say, "Well, oh, it's all for anybody." Yes, it would, if you're not a professional. If you're a professional, your work comes first. Your work comes first, and the emotion can come later, because emotion has nothing to do with the work. It has something to do with it insofar as you know what kind of pictures to take and what kind of questions to ask, what kind of stories to write, and things like that. But when you are a professional, you can do your work and do all sorts of things. Well, there's another experience I think I told you about. Across the street from our home, there was a fire in the field. And so I was having lunch at the time, so I took my camera and went over there. And here was a little boy in the middle of this fire, and it's burning around him, you know. And the Methodist church was over there, and they had come out to see the fire, and they were praying for the kids, I'm sure, and everybody's praying. And I said, "I surround you with my pure white light of love. You're perfectly okay, kid, you know." And so then, what happened? That second, the wind shifted, and the fire blew the other way, and it blew over its burned area, and the kid was right there with no problem. No problem whatsoever. And the fireman ran out to him, said, "Hey, kid, are you okay? Are you okay?" "What do you mean? That was fun. Can we do that again?" You know, kids are great. They're not frightened. They're not worried about these things. But who saved the kid's life? Did I? By saying, I surround him with my pure white light of love? Or did the Methodist or somebody else? If I do not believe that my treatment works, that when I speak my word of healing and wholeness and perfection, if I don't believe in that, then I shouldn't be in the business. If I don't believe that people want to read my newspaper articles and my journalistic pictures that I take, then I should not do it. we had another fire in Wyalusing State Park in Iowa and Wisconsin on the Mississippi River there. And I went over to take pictures of the fire as it was roaring through the park. And big trees just roaring. And what great pictures. And I had my camera. And I was taking pictures. And I was clipping away. And I had my suit coat on and my tie. And I was crazy then in those days. And I had my pipe in my pocket. And, of course, I had my things. And I was just taking pictures and having a great old time. And then after I got a few good trees falling down and other things, I walked out of there, and the firemen were there. And they had all their fire coats on, and they had their oxygen masks on, and they said, "Are you all right? Are you all right?" I said, "Why? Well, you didn't have an oxygen mask. You didn't have anything, you know, and you didn't have anything to protect you." And I said, "I wasn't thinking about being protected. I was thinking about doing my job. I was in there purely doing my job. I was just being a professional. I wasn't thinking about anything." And you read about this all the time in photojournalism and other types of things. The professional is untouched. He walks in and comes out untouched because he's not in there worried. Now, the fireman is a professional at being worried. You know, they're supposed to be afraid of those fires. They're supposed to be afraid that the walls can fall down. They got to watch out every minute for those things. And they're watching for them to fall. And I was just watching for something else, you see. This is why I say to you, lie a little bit. I'm not lying to you. I'm telling you two stories. But lie a little bit. Tell yourself, "I'm not afraid." Just say, "I can handle this. You know, this is just fine. My son is wonderful. My son is unconditional love personified. My son is magnificent." Right? Right? If we say that, now, he may not have been magnificent. He may have a few little hang-ups, a little problems, but you don't dwell on them. You don't empower them. You only empower that which you wish to have empowered. And when you empower that which you wish to have empowered, then that which you wish to have empowered is what is brought forth in your life. Now, do you want that in your life? Do you want that in your life truly? Do you want to have the most gorgeous hair in the world like mine? You know, oh my goodness. Yeah, have you ever seen more wonderful hair than this here? Every one of them is mine, you know. And every one of them is just beautiful. I used to be a blonde. I looked at a picture of myself a couple of years ago when I was 17, graduating from high school, you know. And, man, I was gorgeous. Wow, I think they did a good touch-up job, you know, for childhood acne that I may have had or whatever, but I look so beautiful, and my hair blonde, so perfect. It was just wonderful. But you see, that's the image you want to have of yourself all the time. Have the image of yourself as being whole and perfect all the time, being fulfilled all the time, being gorgeous all the time. Can you do that? Yes. Do you do that? Yes. You know? Do you do that with all of your relatives and your friends, your wives, your husbands, your kids, your aunts, your uncles, your mothers, your fathers, your sisters, your brothers, you know? Do you do it with your grandmas and grandpas? And I tell you, be careful. Don't discount your grandmas and grandpas. They're living longer. They're going to be with you a long time. Not that they're going to be a burden, but they're with you because they're going to be doing their thing. And they're going to be traveling the world, and they're going to be tripping the Light Fantastic, and they're going to be healthy. They're not going to need all these HMOs, and they're not going to need all these medical care centers. And let me tell you a little secret. I told you this before, I'm sure, but let me tell you again. If you will look in the almanac, you know what the almanac is? You look in the almanac. It tells you everything about everything. And you look up hospitals. And you look up world hospitals. You look up hospitals in the world. And you look up the number of people that the hospitals hold in the world. They usually say 100-bed hospital or whatever, you know. And you add them up. And you come up easily 100,000 or under of hospitals, perhaps. And you come up with easily 500,000 or less people in the hospitals. Now, look at it very carefully and very with an objective eye. The number of people who are in hospitals is minuscule minuscule, small. It is tiny, tiny, tiny. Compare it to the population of 6 to 7 billion people on Earth. Now, there's 6 to 7 billion people on Earth. Now, only that amount of people are enjoying hospitals. Now, perhaps they don't have rest homes in there and senior citizen centers and things like that. But, you see, I guarantee you, the senior citizen centers are going to be less and less occupied as the new age of senior citizens are born, so to speak. We say the boomer,
baby boomer.
Well, now, we'll have the senior citizen boomer coming along shortly. And it's not because they're born. It's because they now have become senior citizens who are going to live healthy lives longer. And these senior citizens who are living healthy lives longer are going to be part of our working population, our beneficial population, our happy population. We say, well, the senior citizens should get out of certain jobs because they're taking the jobs that other people can have. No way. No way. When you have a larger population on Earth, you need more people to do all the different jobs that there are to be done. And the senior citizens, as long as they are able to do the job and are healthy and are able to handle it properly, go for it. There's a lot of unhealthy younger people who are doing the job too, you know. And so you don't let that bother you. Now, what I'm trying to say to you is, think about it. Of the population of the world, a very small number are sick people. A much smaller number than that are in our prisons. It's about equal. It's about equal, the number in prisons and the number in hospitals. But so discarding that group of people who are having those problems, look at the population of the world. We are a healthy world. We are a happy world. We are a successful world. Now, how many people died in Armageddon? How many people died in 1988 at the end of the world? That was supposed to be the end of the world, you know. And I would say if anybody died, it was on purpose. You know, they chose to die in the Armageddon, and so they killed themselves, you know, like the Jimmy Jones thing down in South America. But people live. People live. And living is what we are supposed to do. The Bible stories tell us of people who lived hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years. And we should begin to do that. Jesus wasn't a very good example. He just lived 33. But of course, he got killed, so we say, how long would he have lived if he had not been killed? But, say, Livy, here we are living our lives. We are living our lives as beautiful beings. As beautiful, magnificent beings who know that we live in an ideal spirit, mind, and body. We live in an ideal spirit, mind, and body. We live in our ideal spirit, mind, and body. We live in our ideal spirit, mind. Keep saying it, saying it, saying it. I told you the story about my son and his incident with the filling station. Remember that? You know, okay. My son was 23, about, and he turned vegetarian and became a vegetarian at that time, and all of his life now he's a vegetarian. That's his choice. So I had come back from Minneapolis where I had a church, and I had my motorhome, and I drove down to visit him at our ranch. And so when I got there, I said, come on, guys, I'll take you out to dinner. We'll go to a steakhouse, you know. So I took him to a beautiful steakhouse right by the airport. You know, classy steak, real great stuff. And I just enjoyed myself. And I said, what are you going to order? Dad, we're vegetarian. His friends were studying Hinduism and so forth, and they were vegetarian, and he was vegetarian. So, okay, you could have told me before we came here. If you want, you can order some peas and carrots and beans, whatever they got on. No. I said, well, then we'll go to a veggie restaurant after I am done. So just relax and tell me what you've been doing. So I ate, and they told me what they were doing. And I drove them to the veggie restaurant. And when we had the veggie restaurant, Mark got out. He had been driving. And then he got out of the car because I was looking for a parking space. He was going to the restaurant to confirm our reservation. And so he didn't come back. We drove around the block. We didn't find him. And then at a filling station, I saw a pound of a pile of mats laying there, and I knew something was there. I mean, you know, a father knows these things. And so I drove in there, and I ran over there, and there he was. He had run around the corner with his bare feet and gone bong like that and banged his head on the concrete, and he was out for the count. And so I said, "Mark your home perfect, mark your home perfect, mark your home perfect." And he came through for a minute and says, "I know, Dad." And then he went out again, you know. And then the 9/11 came, picked him up, and they drove him to the hospital, and I beat him to the hospital. And we ran up into the emergency ward. It was in the evening, and they wanted to take an x-ray of his head, you know. And so they did, and they said, And I said, yeah. It's home perfect. It's home perfect. It's home perfect. Everybody in the emergency room was hearing me saying that, and the boys saying that, and then they all started saying it. You know, nice treatment. And so then, about half hour later, the doctor comes in. He says, "Now I can x-ray him in the x-ray room, but I haven't got any help. Will you hold his head?" "Oh, boy, will I hold his head." So we went in there, and I held his head firm like a rock, you know. And they took his picture, and it was clear as a bell, you know. But they kept them overnight because that was what they do. But I said, "Mark your home perfect, mark your home perfect, mark your home perfect, mark your home perfect." And I said that and said that and said that. The next morning, they said he's okay. They kept him for observation, you know. But just to watch over him. And he says, "Dad, I'm home perfect." And I said, "Yes." He said, "I'm driving." And so I said, "If I believe you're home perfect, you drive." So he drove, and he was home perfect. Now, Ellen had a call from her daughter in Switzerland who has a son who has a son, and this son, she had five kids, and this is the youngest son, who was maybe about 12 or 13, and he went for a marathon race, a world marathon race that is being held in Switzerland of running and skiing and all that sort of stuff, and the temperature dropped down, was it 50 degrees below centigrade, which isn't all that much, but it's a lot for them who weren't used to it. And so in the process, the kid fell down, and he froze his hand from here to here, you know. And so they rushed him off to the hospital, and Ellen was called right away, and she says, "He's home perfect, he's home perfect, he's home perfect." And so the mother went in and said, "You're home perfect, you're home perfect, you're home perfect." And so the doctor came out and said, "Well, if it were a man, we'd cut it off. But since it's a youngster, it'll grow back, and it'll perfect, not grow back, but I mean, it'll readjust itself." And so it is, it's perfect now. But you see, Ellen instantly said, "I'm home perfect." She instantly put that cause in motion. You, when you have in your heart, I'm home perfect, he's home perfect, it's home perfect, whatever you're talking about, dum, 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 it's done. It's such a positive, dynamic, powerful statement, and it's so effective, it works in every beautiful way. Now, if you have any other requests, you know, if you have a request for your physique, you know, your body, you want to have the perfect physique, you know, Herb, I'm working on it, I'm doing pretty good. I have the most wonderful body I could ever imagine. I have the most wonderful body I could ever imagine. Thank you, Brad. He didn't laugh. But I have the most wonderful body.
I can't imagine how you guys handle all that cold being nudist
in Campo. The cold what?
I know how cold it gets in Campo. I was just sitting there thinking, how do you guys handle that being nudist?
No problem. You don't think about the cold. No, you just think about the joy of living there and the joy of being there. And, today I think they told me it was something like 75, you know, which is not bad. So, when you have a request for yourself, and if the request is your personal body, don't go looking for diets. Don't go taking diets and following diets and being vegetarian and being a meatarian and do whatever. Just say to yourself, "I have the perfect body. I have the perfect body. I have the perfect body. I have the perfect body. And I have the perfect body. And I like..."
Meditate
I know, but this isn't the place to meditate. It's the place to listen, and I'm sure he's listening. And if he's not listening, I'll throw a cushion at him. But I have the perfect body. I have the perfect body. I have the perfect body. That's all you want to say. Okay, let's take the doctor. Let's go into his clinic. And he has these dogs coming into his clinic, and cats, and horses, and pigs, and cows, and sheep, and whatever, you name it. And little boys and little girls. He has to work on them too, you know. He has little boys and little girls who come in there crying their heart out over their pet. And he has to get them to change their attitude. My pet's dying. Your pet is perfectly okay. Your pet is fine. Your pet is doing just wonderful. Your pet's going to be all right now. Just let's recognize your pet. See, he has to do this positive thing with these children. What kind of a cruel monster would he be if he said to the children, okay, that's right, your pet doesn't stand a chance. Let's kill him now. And they say, boy, are you a nice doctor. Let mama, let's go someplace else, you know. And, of course, it may have been the proper thing to do, but not worded that way. So, you, in making your statement for yourself, what are you going to say about your healing of your body? What are you going to say about your perfect body? Are you going to say, I like to have my little old pot belly here? Or you say, I like to have my slim body, or I like to have this or that? What do you say? What do you say about yourself? Do you say, I have such a wonderful body. 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 Yes, I do. Oh, I do. I have such a wonderful body. Yes, I do. Oh, I do. I have such a wonderful body. So, you see, you sing the song if you want. Now, I've told you this story before, I'm sure. The cowboys sing these lonesome songs, and they sing these songs about their wife running away with the cat and stuff like that. And that happens too. The wife thinks more of the cat than she does the husband, you know. So she takes the cat and runs. And the checkbook and a few other things, you know. And that's all good. But these guys deserve to lose their wives. They deserve to lose their husbands because they sing such melancholy songs about them. Now, all they have to do is start singing, I have such a wonderful wife. I have such a wonderful life. I have such a wonderful wife. I have such a wonderful wife. Praise Maria, praise Maria. I have such a wonderful life. Praise Maria, praise Maria. I have such a wonderful wife. You see, now isn't that a lot better? My wife ran away with the cat. She took the checkbook. She cleaned it up before she left the bank and snook. But, no, it's okay. But see, that's all dumb stuff. That's all negative stuff that you don't want to put in motion at all. You don't want to put that in consciousness at all. And it's so silly to do that. What are you going to do? How are you going to work your life? When you make changes, then, of course, you do everything in divine order. But up until then, you continually speak your word that you have a perfect wife, a perfect husband, a perfect family. Now, if you go through problems, go through problems. But always have the attitude of what you want. Now, if you want a separation, if you want to be separated from the person that you're married with, whatever it may be, that's just fine too. But just remember, don't plan on getting married again. Because you'll marry the same person. Because whatever that person is that you are getting separated from is the kind of person that you like. Oh, no, I don't. Oh, yes, you do. Now, if you don't like that as a person, he always does this, he always does this. You say, yes, he always buys me flowers. He always brings me chocolates. He always comes and hugs me when he comes in the house. He always comes and tells me what a wonderful privilege it is to be my husband. Who's talking about what? what a wonderful privilege it is to be my husband, she says. And you see, when she says those things, what happens? So it is. No matter how grisly he may be, no matter how uncouth he may be, no matter how unrighteous he may be, with unconditional love, you create that being what you want. Because if you don't, you're going to create the next one the same way, he's going to be a drunkard, or he's going to be thoughtless, or whatever. So you might as well take the one you got and train them from right where you are and say, my wife is a lovely, gentle, fantastic woman who thinks I'm just the greatest being on the face of the earth. And of course, that's how I think about her. She's the greatest being. And say these things. Now, perhaps at the moment it may not be true. Perhaps at the moment it may not be at all. But was she ever that way? Was she ever the greatest person on earth? Is that why you married her? If she ever was, then her original purity and integrity was being that way. You understand? Her original purity was being that way. And you return to that original purity of that relationship, of a perfect relationship, of a perfect experience, being together. Can you understand that? And now, do you want to save your marriage? If you do, take a gun and shoot it. Because if you want to save it, that means that it's somebody else's fault. If you want to save your marriage, and if, in other words, you want your marriage to be the most beautiful, do you want your marriage to be the most beautiful marriage on earth? Is that a nice idea? Have your marriage be the most beautiful marriage on earth? Does that sound good?
Mm-hmm.
No? Yeah? Yeah, well, don't you? I mean, it may not be your personal wish, but I mean, as a principle, it's a good idea, right? Okay, right? Now, see, the doctor and his wife over here, they have the perfect marriage. She does what she wants to do, and he does what he wants to do, and together they do what they want to do. And they just have a good time. And none of them think that the other is doing something wrong when they're doing what they want to do. The doctor says, hey, sweetheart, I'm going off for a safari with the judge. We're going to go down, have a good time down in Africa. And she says, oh, wow, yes, and take your camera. I want to see all those wonderful pictures. And he says, but I might not go there. I might end up someplace else. Well, take a picture wherever you go, you know. I don't care where it is. Wherever it is, it's going to be good, because whatever you do, sweetheart, is good. Whatever you do is wonderful. And what a wife. Now, it takes a husband to be like that, to have a wife who's like that. You understand? Now, and you think I'm joking? No way. I've been in this business for a long time. I've been in the ministerial business for a long time. I had newspapers, and the different churches in the area of my newspaper would always call me in to give their Sunday talks when the minister was away or sick or off visiting his grandmother or something. And so they didn't, because they weren't afraid I was going to steal their church by being so wonderful. So I would go in and I'd talk to their church, and I listen to the people and to this, what's in their heart. And as I listen to what's in their heart, then they would spill the beans from the audience, you know, from the congregation. And so then I'd start speaking about their particular circumstances in the congregation, and they said, well, how did you know that? How did you know that? And I said, how did I know what? Well, that's what I was going through with my wife. I said, is done. Just done, it's done. And then, oh yes, I got the right solution now to handle that perfectly. You know, I'm very happy about that. But you see, when you're in this business, constantly, you're in this professionally, I am not touched by anybody's attitudes or anybody's statements. But a lot of times I talk to prisoners, and prisoners, you know, are very gruff in their attitude of language and things like that. And at first, when I'm talking to some, they swear and use bad language, and I don't say anything. And then they say to each other, hey, he's a minister, you know, shouldn't talk like that in front of him, he's a minister. And I say, hey, talk however you are. If that's who you are, and if that's who you think you are to express yourself, go right ahead. But if you think that you have a better vocabulary than that, then use it. And, you know, nobody respects you for being something that you're not. Everybody respects you for being who you are, even if who you are is not a very nice person. They respect you for being who you are. And this is what I suggest to everyone. Be who you are. So, this is what happens. This is what happens. You are the master. You are in charge. And life is so wonderful. I had a newspaper in Atwater, California, and across the street was the Methodist Church. And my wife was the organist and the secretary for the Methodist Church. And we were unity. And so I would write our talks and write our, you know, the newspaper, and then I would go over and see what she was doing. And then he was very much into the McCarthy thing and stuff like that, and so he was away from the office a lot. And he'd always ask me to take over his pulpit when he was away. And so I would, and I would just have a great time in there. And I would countermand everything he was doing with the McCarthy group. And I would say, we do not judge people. We only recognize the truth about them, that in every man is the spirit of good, in every man is the truth and honesty and goodness. And this, your minister, you know, it was just so fantastic and so glorious and so, you know, building him up in the positive line, in the positive way. And so when he came back, the congregation all went to him and said, oh, it's so good to hear that you're doing this in this positive way, and you're doing that in that positive way. And Herb told us all about how you work with people and how you change their lives by a positive attitude. And wow, you know, you're fantastic. I need to talk to you. You know, and he said, oh, okay. He didn't know that he was doing that, but he did. McMichaels was his name. Yeah, Jim McMichaels. And he was quite a character, quite a character. But it was so beautiful because it was so lovely. I had the newspaper here on this corner, Methodist Church here, the City Hall here, and the Public Library here. So everything, and the Fire Department next to the City Hall. So I had everything that I needed to cover, and I could just walk by foot. And it was so glorious because I would cover the City Hall meetings, and I'd be writing about what these legislators are saying, the aldermen, I think, no, they were called councilmen. And in West Dallas, they were aldermen. But the councilmen were doing. And I would write it down. And now it's 10:30 at night. And I would leave. They'd go out and have a beer, and I'd go across the street to my office. And on my old Royal typewriter, blah, 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 and click out the stories. And then it would be in the paper the next day. And they'd read it, and they'd say, my God! You took out all of my vituperations. You took out all of my swearing. You took out all of my, thank you, Herb, thank you. People will re-elect me. And I said, well, you were had the anxiety of the moment going, and I felt I should, polish you up just a little bit. And they wanted me to run for mayor because I had polished, I said, but if I run for mayor, then I'd make it, but I couldn't write about what I'm doing anymore. I couldn't be objective because I would have ulterior motives that I'd be working on. And this is what each one of us has to be careful about. When we are working with ourselves, do we have an ulterior motive? Do we have an ulterior motive? Why do you want to be slim and trim and happy? Is it because you want to get somebody or attract somebody into your life? Or because you just want to feel how it feels to be the most healthy, happy, handsome being on the face of the earth? You know? What's your reason? And when you have the right reasons, then it works. You see, when you're... I have a woman, Edith Mary Sanderson, lovely lady, known her since I went to Minneapolis to be the minister of that church, and she was head of the Board of Regents, and she was in charge of me. She had to make sure I was happy. She was a bachelorette, and I was a bachelor. And she always cooked for me, worked for me, did everything for me. And she was just a good little girl. Well, she always was chubby, and she didn't like being chubby. She wanted to be thin. And I said, Aunt Mary, you are a very charming, beautiful woman. You are chubby, and that's what you are. And you are great. You know, there's nothing wrong with being chubby. You're just great. And so, as long as I was around her, she was okay. Then, I went away from Minneapolis, and she stayed there as head of the school food service department for the city up there. And I went down to California. And so, what does she do? She gets herself a diet. I don't know what kind of diet it is. I don't think it was any bad diet, but it was just a diet. And she dieted, and she got herself so slim trim. So charmingly attractive. She's a short lady, you know. And she was, you know, a little husky, but she was very lovely. And she bought a whole new wardrobe, which is what you always do, you know. And she came down to the ranch to show me. And she was so proud of it. And I said, Edith Mary, did you do that for yourself or did you do that for me? I said, if you do that for me, that's the wrong reason. If you do that for yourself, that's the right reason. And I said, if you do it for me, it doesn't make any difference. I love you just the way you are. You're a very fantastic lady, whether you have an extra pound or two, or whether you're a Slim Jim just the way you are now. And she said, oh, I did this just for you, and you don't appreciate it, and you don't understand, and I did it just for you. And she went back home, and she filled out. All her new clothes had to be thrown away. But she filled out. You see, when we do things for people, it's bad. I wasn't mean to her. I just told her, don't have that as your reason. Because then, if you're ever mad at me, then you'll eat and stuff and eat. And if you're ever happy with me, then you'll starve. You know? And that's a foolish thing to do. And we do that with ourselves. When we hate ourselves, we stuff ourselves. When we like ourselves, then we starve ourselves. And when we starve ourselves, then we don't like ourselves, so then we stuff ourselves. It's a never-ending cycle that we go through of mismanagement of motivation. And we want to motivate ourselves with the proper manner of motivating ourselves. Now, how do you want to motivate yourself? Do you want to motivate yourself to be the most glorious being on the face of the earth? Do you want to motivate yourself to being the happiest person that ever lived? If you do, then this little illustration that will please Brad very much is something that you might think about. Brad, in Tierra del Sol, you know where Tierra del Sol is? Tierra del Sol is up by us. Tierra del Fuego is on the tip of South America. The tip of South America. There's an island down there called Tierra del Fuego, and it is a tip. And natives lived on Tierra del Fuego historically for, you know, maybe thousands of years, hundreds of years, definitely. And when the explorers came around, the pioneer explorers, when they came around the tip of South America, they stopped. And they saw these Indians. And these Indians were naked. And they were walking in the ocean, catching fish, and bringing them out. And then when they brought them out, then they put this fur piece over their shoulder and hung it around them, and they put the fish in it. They didn't use it to cover themselves. And when they were fishing, their children were there. And the children would play in the icy, cold, frigid waters right from the Antarctic. And they wouldn't freeze themselves. They were just as happy as could be. They would go to their camp, and they would cook the fish. And they would sit on their robe. They wouldn't wear it. Because their body temperature was acclimated to the weather. Now, the weather was extremely cold, and yet they were not cold. And they wore nothing at all. Now, how could they do that? It was all in the mind. It had to be. It had to be. Because the explorers were wrapped up like teddy bears, you know. They were really cold. But the natives, they didn't have to do that because they had this natural. Now, they had several articles on this in the National Geographic. And, of course, they had pictures of people drawings from the way the explorers had written about them in their reports, in their journals. And it's quite fantastic when you think about it. Now, of course, what happened? As the explorers came around, the explorers had to mess them up like they messed up the Hawaiians and got clothing on the Hawaiians so that the Hawaiian people ended up with a lot of diseases and illnesses that they're uninhibited naturalness did not bring to them. And so I'm sure the Tierra del Fuego people also went by the wayside. And Cortez, when he came into Mexico, he came into Mexico City with his band of people, and they took over the city and were worshipped and honored. But because his men had fraternized with women everywhere and under every circumstance, they brought with them many diseases that they were not aware of in those countries, syphilis and what have you. But the worst thing they brought in was what? Do you remember the disease?
Smallpox.
Smallpox killed off 99% of the population of Mexico City. Boom! Just like that. And so Cortez had nothing. And he went home with a diminishment of his own team and so forth. But you see, this is what we do when we bring and try to force our culture on the cultures of other people. And we try to force our cultures onto our family. We say, hey, in this family we do this, in this family we do this. What is the best example? Now, there's the answer. What is the best way to teach how to do things is to be an example. So if you're going to be a practitioner, you want to be an example. Now, a practitioner is someone who practices what they believe. And a practitioner is also someone who goes in expecting to bring wholeness to the people who are involved. A practitioner goes in expecting to bring wholeness to those involved. Why? Because the practitioner sees everyone whole and perfect. A practitioner does not see something to heal. So if you are a practitioner, you want to bring it in there and not see somebody who needs to be healed, but see everyone whole and perfect. You follow me? Mm-hmm. And if you see everyone whole and perfect, then what happens? There's no work to be done. If every animal that came into the animal kingdom over here came in with the idea that it was whole and perfect, they would just hold out their hand and say, $50, please. You know. But no, can you imagine? They're not an overnight clinic. They are a daily clinic. And so they would say to the people, give me your pet. And I want to come too. No, just give me your pet. And then they go in the back room and they whisper in the pet's ear, you're whole and perfect. And then the pet says, I was waiting to hear that. And the pet jumps off his lap and dashes back to its master and waggles its tail, and the master says, he's whole and perfect. That's right, he's whole and perfect. Go and see the cashier. But you see, that's what they teach. That's what they should be expressing. Yes. Mm-hmm.
What was your first experience with learning that you were whole and perfect?
Learning that I was not whole and perfect.
No, that you were whole and perfect.
Learning that I was not whole and perfect, I should have said not. Ever since I was a little child, I always felt whole. I had childhood experiences, I'm sure. I had mumps probably, or chicken pox, or broken legs. I had 5 broken legs, you know, and these different things now. But I never was sick. I would have a broken leg, and they'd get cast on me, and my sisters would push me around the block in the baby buggy, and I'd just be having a ball. And they'd bring me chocolate-covered cherries, and I'd be, that's all I remember. I mean, everything I did was a joyous, wonderful adventure. Even those experiences, which were not too nice. Older kids, and I was the almost the youngest. The youngest was too young to get in trouble yet. And so I would follow after everybody else, and the car would hit me, and I'd fly through the windshield, and land in the back seat, and he'd take me to the hospital. This was in the 20s, you know, in the 30s. And so it was a great experience. And in the hospital, they'd just all treat me and pick the glass out of me, and we all say, but, you know, I wasn't hurting. I never hurt. I was very blessed. You might say, you mean you're immune to being hurt? Well, I imagine I could feel pain sometimes, but I don't create myself feeling pain. I create myself whole and perfect. And this is a wonderful way to be. And with my staff on campus, and they come up to me, if you hurt, what am I going to do? I got this here, I got this. I said, okay, how long do you want it? I said, how long do you want it? Well, I don't. Well, then why did you tell me about it? Now, what do you want? What wouldst thou of me? Don't forget, I'm Jesus. I am the Christ. I can only give you what you ask for. Well, I want to be whole and perfect. Okay, you're whole and perfect right now. Now, what else do you want? That can't be so quick, but it is. It's done. Now, you accept it. Jesus said to the his centurion, go home and tell your soldier, you know, tell him first. Centurion says, that's the way I handle things. I give the orders and they do it. You're holding bird. Now, get up and walk, you know. And that's just the way it is. Now, illness is like that. Illness. I had a very rough young life. I was a very deprived child. I lived in a family of four other kids, you know, and it was in Depression times, and the other kids all did their own thing. I never saw them. My older brother, I never saw him. I hardly ever knew him. My two sisters, who were 3 or 4 years older than I, they were off doing their thing all the time, and they certainly didn't want me around, you know. And my younger brother, who was 3 years younger than me, I certainly didn't want him around, you know. But I was off doing my own thing. And I had a very practical thing. I was a very nice guy. I was a very, very nice guy. I would go visit all the neighborhood ladies. And I would go in their home and sit and talk with them. And they would have all of their little worries and their little problems, and they'd tell me. And I would be a little counselor. And I didn't counsel, I didn't say, I just said the right things.
How old
were
you?
Right. I was very blessed. And they would tell me the troubles they're having with their husband and things like that. And they wouldn't say the naughty things, you know, that I shouldn't know. Or maybe they did and I didn't know, you know, which was okay too. But they would tell me all the things of problems. And I'd say, but he's such a nice guy, you know. And but he's so thoughtful and he's so loving with us kids. And look at how he handles the kids. And he's such a nice guy. I'm sure that he didn't mean that. I'm sure. You know, I'd say all these silly things, you know. But they were the right things. And by the time I got done talking, would you like another handful of brown sugar? You know, give me a handful of brown sugar. It was so wonderful. But, you know, nobody else had that, but I got it. And it was a treat. And then Mrs. Kudnich next door, her husband was dying of something or other, and he was in bed dying a long time. And every day I'd come home from school, I'd go up to his room, and I'd say, and there's Robert Kudnich. I'd say, Mr. Kudnich? What a name to pronounce, you know. Mr. Kudnich? I'd say, how are you doing today? And he'd say, oh, I'm better today. I said, you look so wonderful. You look so fantastic. It is so nice to have you as a friend. He says, he called me Junior. And he said, Junior, you are my friend. You are my friend. You are my only friend. I said, but you've got such a nice wife. You know, she is so wonderful. You know, she always makes me a sandwich when I come in to see you. And she always brings me some soda water or something, you know, which I don't get at home and stuff. And, you know, she's nice, you know. And Aunt B, her sister, would take me to the art studio and be a model, you know, for art. And I was 7, 8 years old, but it was great. But, you see, I would always say these things. I would say, you know, he is such a nice guy. He's so wonderful. He's so thoughtful. Or your wife is such a wonderful. And when he died, which was seemed like forever, but it was, of course, maybe just 6 months or so. And when he died, before he died, he says, Junior, nobody wants my car. I give my car to you, my car. You know,
when
I was 6, 7 years old. So I went in this garage, and it was up on blocks, you know. And I drove that car all over. I had all my friends in the car. It was a Hubmobile. Have you ever heard of a Hubmobile? But it was like an old Oldsmobile, but it was just beautiful. And I drove it for, oh, a couple of months at least. And all of a sudden, I had other interests, and then it wasn't there anymore. I don't know where my car went. It didn't matter. But everybody in the neighborhood, and then one woman, she was having difficulty because her husband went to jail. He went to prison. And her daughter was, I wasn't old enough to have her as a girlfriend yet, but she was nice. And her name is Patsy Means. And so her husband went to prison. And naturally, she was unhappy. And I would sit and talk with her at the kitchen table. And I would drink milk or something, and she'd be drinking coffee. And she'd be telling me her problems, sobbing and sobbing and sobbing and sobbing. And I'd say, well, isn't it wonderful he's not dead? Isn't it wonderful that he's going to come home in not too long? You know, it's only a couple of years that he's got to be in prison for embezzlement or something else. Isn't it wonderful he'll be home and soon? But what about my children? Hey, those things, don't worry about that. That's nothing. I didn't have the intelligence to say, this too shall pass, you know, or when time goes by and then people forget those things and it doesn't matter, you know. But she got the message. And I don't remember him coming home because I had changed my directions of going up another block, another street, and having more beautiful experiences. But you see, I think when you are sort of have a happy heart, and when you like yourself, and when you like your world, and you don't think that you have to do anything to it, you just be yourself and have fun. I wasn't putting on a show for these ladies. I wasn't pretending to be something for these ladies. I didn't know how. I just knew how to just be myself and enjoy that wonderful brown sugar. That was so precious. And Mrs. Ring, she was another thing. Her wife was Colonel Ring, and Jasper and Jimmy Ring were her kids. And he had been very active in the military and very in the First World War and very, very proper and very this and that and the other thing and mucky. And she was feeling poorly. And I talked with her at her kitchen table for about a year and a half. And then she just felt so peaceful about it all. And her husband said to me, Junior, come anytime you want. Come anytime. You make Mother feel so good, you know. And Jimmy and Jaffe were good guys, but they were older than I, and so they were not in my playground area. But one day I came to visit Mrs. Ring, and they were all sitting at the kitchen table, and they said, Junior, last night Mother died, and she went away to be with the angels, you know. And I said, oh, wow, isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful? And they were sad. And I said, isn't that wonderful? Isn't that great? She's now released. She doesn't have that hurt in her heart anymore. She doesn't have that pain anymore. Isn't that wonderful? Wonderful. Yeah, I was stupid. You're just saying these things. And they had to laugh. And they had to say, you're right. We were just sorry for ourselves because we miss her so. And thank you, Junior. Thank you. Did I remember that? Did I remember that? Not because I was so proud of it, but because when you let yourself intuitively and inspirationally say things, you say the right thing at the right time in the right way to the right people for the right purpose. And it was fantastic. And you see, she enjoyed our conversation so much. Because I was like a tiny adult. That's probably how she saw me. And she just said anything that came to her heart, and she knew that I was going to say something nice about it. Because I didn't know how to say something naughty nice. And there was another woman just up the street from us. And she was a lovely lady, just a lovely lady. And she didn't have her husband, he died or something. And one day she came to me, and she says, Herbie, I was Herbie now. She says, Herbie, would you do me a favor? And I said, well, what is that? She says, I will park my car in the street, and will you drive it into my garage every night, and will you take it out every morning? And I said, sure. And she says, last night, my daughter was in the garage with the car, and she closed the garage door, and she asphyxiated herself. She died. And I said, last night? I said, oh, you are precious. You are wonderful. I said, can I help you? Can I be there? And so I went into the house. I was the only person she had there because there were no relatives. You know, there were no friends around. And so here I was with her, having this beautiful experience, talking to her, sharing with her, loving her, letting her tell how much she missed her daughter. And I said, she's not gone. I mean, I see her. I think about her. I can see her. You know, I can see her, you know, driving her car. I can, wrong thing to say. I can see her driving her car. I can see her doing this and that. But it was the right thing to say because she had to face it, you know. And when she got done, she just says, oh, I'm so happy. I'm so happy, you know. She says, I'm glad she's gone because her heart was so heavy. She had many problems that she didn't mention. And so, but she went and life was good for her. But then for the next 2 years, I drove her car in and out of her garage for her every day. A beautiful Packard, brand new Packard back in whatever it was, I was probably about 12 at the time, not old enough to drive legally or anything, you know, but enter a drive and out, I could do that. But it was great. It was really great. But you see, these are how these things happen. And speaking about this, since you haven't let me be quiet about it, my neighbor next door, Mrs. DeSwart, I should be quiet. Our neighbor, Mrs. DeSwart, she had me clean her house every day and every week and paid me 50 cents for cleaning her whole house once a week. And I did that. Well, I went into her house one Saturday, and as I walked into the house, nobody was around. They were downstairs in the study doing something, and so I just went on upstairs to clean the bedrooms and stuff. And in the bedroom, there was her husband, and he was very sick and very dying, you know. And so I was the only one there. And so I talked to him, and I said, "Well, Mr. DeSwart, how are you doing today?" He says, "I don't feel too good." And I said, "Oh, are you going to die?" You know, he says, "I think so." And I said, "Okay, then when you die, you'll be just as happy as Mrs. Ring and as everybody else here." And he says, "Oh, thank you." He says, "I needed that." He says, "The minister says I should prepare my soul for the Lord and I should do these things, but you say I should be happy. And you're such a little rascal, you know." And he says, "I always thought you were not a good kid, you know, because you always minded your mother. You were such a behavior boy, you know." I said, "Well, I don't let on." And so he says, "Well, thank you." And he says, "I heard." And yeah. He said, "Will you hold my hand?" And I said, "Sure." So I held his hand and poof, off he went. And I was still holding his hand because he didn't say let go, you know, but he died. And so then his wife and the group came up and they saw me holding his hand and they say, Father, what is this? What is this?" You know, they were so formal, you know, calling him Father, you know, because they had a lot of money. And I said, "He said that he's happy, and he said that he's going, and he said that he's so happy that I'm here to hold his hand when he went." "You held his hand when he went? Oh, thank you, Herbie. Now you can go home." And I said, "Okay, you know." And so I went home. But you know, what else could they say? You know, they're like speechless in a situation like that. But then later, I came back and next day or so, and she said, What did he say? You know, what were your last words?" And so forth. And so I could remember that and tell her right away. And you see, when you have a totally loving heart, when you don't want anything for yourself, or when your whole life is just to give, it comes back to you in tons and tons and tons, but that's not why you do it. You just give it, and you feel so good. You feel so full. Oh, I could have been a little more maudlin with some of the stories and brought you all to tears because it brought me to tears as I was experiencing them. But it was great. It was great. And this is what each one of you want to do. Each one of you want to live your life so wonderfully that every single moment is an adventure. Every single moment is a fulfilled experience that is so fantastic that life is beautiful. And you see, they didn't die. All of my lady friends and the men who I knew in the neighborhood, there are others too, they didn't die. And I knew them all. And I mean, how many children have the opportunity of knowing that many people at death at that early age? And just on a casual basis as a neighbor type of thing, you know. And we all do. But we're all afraid of it. Because we think that death is something definitely that's evil, something that is taking us away from our loved one, taking us away from life. We think that death is something that is going to destroy us and keep us out of the joy of being ourselves. We think that death is something so ugly. Well, death is not. Death is just our bus pass to the next adventure. And all we're doing is getting on whatever vehicle it is that's taking us to the next adventure. And the vehicle may be our bodies. We may take our bodies with us. You don't know many people who did it because you don't know many people who did it because they did it and you don't know that they did it. You know what I mean? And that's true. You don't know. And just like people who have spiritual healing, they don't know they had a spiritual healing because they don't know they were ever ill. Spiritual healing is that way. So death is something that is just, now listen to these words carefully because I mean them so definitely. Death is just a continuation of life. Death is life continuing. Death is life continuing as though you'd get on a ship and go over the horizon, as though you'd get in a bus and go away. You don't think a thing about getting in a bus and going away, you know? And so it is. And when Mr. Kunlich went, you know, I had the privilege of being there. And Aunt B was there, and Mrs. Kunlich was there, but they were not. And then my mother, I didn't tell you about her. My mother, she's just somebody I dearly, dearly loved, and she's always, we've always been close, but she's always let me do my own thing. Well, she was 72. She was living in Leisure World in California, and she had had a couple of upsets in her life and some illnesses and stuff, and it was making her very unhappy and very weak. And so finally she said, "Herbie, I want to go." And I said, "Mom, I just got my practitioner certificate from the United Church of Religious Science, and you shouldn't go until you've got yourself in order now. You should get your body in order. And then when you got your body in order, then you can go if you want, you know." And she says, "I want to go now." I said, "Mom." And she says, "You're holding on to me." And I said, "Yes." She says, "You're holding on to me." She said, "Now let me go." And I said, "Mom," you know, "all right, just remember Jesus said there's a mansion in heaven just for you, waiting for you, so go if you want, you know." And so she closed her eyes and went. She went. And I was so startled and happy for her, because there's no more pain, there's no more feeling of unhappiness, but I was happy for her. And then at that moment, I saw her ectoplasm leave her body, which was a grand experience. I had seen that 3 times before. I could write a book about my people I know in death. And it went right up, and I watched it, and I thought, cool. You know, different. And then I took her arms and folded across her chest, because she had let it slide down on the edge of the bed and stuff, and her eyes were closed. And I said to my sister, who was in the kitchen, I said, "Marie, I think Mother's left us, you know." And she came in, and she said, "Herbie, you're always there when someone goes. You're always there. And what a wonderful conductor you are for them to go into their next adventure." And is that so true? But you see, that's what we are all about. That's what we are all about. We have the privilege of being aware of moving people to their next adventure and having their next exciting activity. And do you want to? Or are you looking at it as something so mystical and so obtuse and so obsolete and so unhappy and so unkind? Or are you looking at it just as a release from illness, a release from pain, a release from unhappiness? Those are not really happy reasons to do it. You want to let go of life, if you might call it that, or let go of this dimension of life to go on to your next dimension of life, to have fun. But wouldn't it be nice, and I will tell you this series of stories another time, but wouldn't it be nice if there was someone who would talk to you at the time you're thinking of dying and tell you what they believe you're going to be experiencing in your next dimension of freedom, of the opportunity to be all that you could ever dream of being, to express your imagination, to express your brilliance, to express your purity, to express your wholeness? Wouldn't it be great if someone were there to talk to them like that just before they move on, and then they're moving, "Hey, let go, I want to go, I'm ready for that next adventure." And it is so. But I'll tell you those stories another time. But they are great, and I've got about six of them. So they're really nice, and it is really something very, very wonderful and very, very exciting. Yeah. I just buried my sister and buried my brother. My sister was 78, my brother was 82, 83. And each one of them died happy. They went through a lot of misery before they died, but they died happy. Because I told them, hey, I said, I'm not sorry for you. You've made this of your body, and I'd say goodbye to your body and go and live your happy life, whatever you want. But don't hang in here. You made your body sick. No, you could have made it well, but if you don't want to, you don't have to. Mom didn't have to, you know. And so both of them. And so what does my brother do? Ellen and Sylvia were there visiting him, and the nurse comes in. He says, oh, nurse. And she says, yes. He says, I have something on my lips here. And she says, yes, I don't see anything. He says, well, kiss me. And she says, Ray, you clown, you. But you see, always he had this humor in him. Always he had this smile and this fantasticness. And like I say, that's another topic, and it's a beautiful one. So, my goodness, I got into realms today that exceeded the healing and went into the wholeness and went into the immortality that we are. And we are immortal. And we do live forever. And it's about time that we start enjoying this life without worrying about the to come. Because if we're so concerned about what's going to come, then we're not living in the now. And if we more live in the now, oh, live in the now as your angel self. Live in the now as your divine self. Live in the now as your whatever words you want to use for it. But live in the now. And as you live in the now, it's fun. If you're going to wait until you pass over, or as wait until you make that big journey into the next. Okay, I'll make another comment here, because I'm sure we have another few minutes if I want it.
I have some questions.
I don't care about questions. Think about this. What was I going to tell you? It must have been terribly important. It was a great little. It's about death. It's about dying. And it's about not dying. And it's about immortality. And it's about. Let's make your tape run out. You had enough of that, huh?
Go on.
What is it that I'm trying to remember the question. What is it that I guess you're just not supposed to have that right now. It'll have to come at another time. But it was great.
We'll have
Maya
ask you a question, and maybe
we'll
come back to
you. Okay, ask the question. Who was first? Go ahead. Ask it loud enough so the tape picks it up.
Okay.
Tight trousers.
Yeah. Well, I did this thing about the only thing that I want to know about is not something that I'm thinking about. So that's why I'm taking this minute. Because
the only thing you want to know about is something you're not thinking about?
Right. If I'm thinking about it, I have an idea that I'm in my ego mind, and it's my mind that wants to figure it out and analyze it, and it's just something of the ego.
Yes.
But when there's an opportunity to ask a question of the likes of you, I want it to be what I really need to know. And
I go to your beautiful children.
The question I have is about peace.
Peace.
Yes. Mm. So I hear something in your speaking that's double-sided to me.
Double-sided.
Right. So on one hand, I'm hearing that in order to experience peace, I need to be a cause for peace.
You need to be a what?
A cause for peace. I need to be the peace that I want.
You have to be peace.
Right. I have to be peace.
Go ahead.
So,
Yeah, which you are, but that's okay.
When I'm noticing that there isn't peace somewhere, I'm noticing, your teaching is that I'm noticing it's not in me, or I wouldn't see it.
No, you're noticing that there is a condition of conflict.
Unlike peace.
If you want to say.
Okay.
But you're noticing that, call it by what it's called. It is not unlike peace. It has nothing to do with peace. It's conflict, you know. And conflict is conflict, and peace is peace.
Okay.
Now, to be whole and perfect, or to be sick? Now, is to be sick to be whole and perfect? No. To be whole and perfect, is whole and perfect. To be sick, to be sick. Okay, but go ahead, but I'm not trying to be mean or terrible to you.
No, I'm still being mean. A situation has been offered to me to organize and lead peace meditations. And I'm unaware of knowing how to do anything about that. So
here's how you do it. Mm-hmm. Here's how you lead a peace meditation. Mm-hmm. Anyone want to tell her?
Be peaceful and you meditate.
No. Don't be so silly. You know, no, there is peace on earth, and it has begun with me. Now there is peace on earth, the peace what was meant to be. I started too high, didn't I? So, you see, the thing is, that is what you're telling your peace group. You're not telling their peace group that there's peace in Iraq and peace in Iran and peace in Afghanistan. They rhyme, don't they? So, you don't say that. You say to your group, now there is peace on earth and it began. Let us look at each of these nations and see them as peaceful nations. Let us see the governors and the governing body of these nations interested in peace, interested in harmony, interested in maintaining their country on the highest levels of peace and of integrity, of honesty, of purity and goodness. See all these. Hey, and I go to Nigeria, and in Nigeria, that's a nation lying on a bed of oil. It's the eighth largest oil reserve in the world. And they're a poverty-stricken country. And I tell them, hey, you are lying on a bed of oil. This is, I bless Nigeria, land that I love. I stand beside her and guide her through the night with the light from above. From the mountains to the prairies to the oceans white with foam, I bless Nigeria, my home sweet home. They laugh at that. I bless Nigeria, my home sweet home. And I teach them to sing that. I teach them to sing that. I teach them to sing that. Their fathers, the ones who are in school that I talk to in the school children, they are the governing body. They are the ones who are running the country. They are the ones. And then I get on the television there, and I sing this song on television. And I sing, I bless Nigeria, I bless Ghana, I bless Guyana, I bless Switzerland, I bless Germany, I bless London, or Great Britain, or whatever we say. And I do it for every country. I bless Italy, I bless Austria, I bless Russia. And I've been in all these countries blessing the hell out of them, you know, and having a ball. But I do not tell them how to bring peace. I tell them they are peace. And if you say, let us have a prayer for peace, excuse me, a 9 p.m. vigil, you know, and in our 9 p.m. vigil, we will see all the nations on earth joining with us in this vigil for peace, and all the nations of earth are accepting that they are peaceful. They have laid down their guns and their ammunition and so forth. Hey, when you say, I'm whole and perfect, you're whole and perfect, you don't know that you may be being whole and perfect in your heart. That may have been your physical problem. You may not know that you're being whole and perfect in your gallbladder, that was your problem, or whatever else. You just say, I'm whole and perfect. So when you say, there now is peace on earth, and it began with me, you have said the most beautiful blessing statement for the universe. There now is peace in my universe. Isn't that interesting, you know? And it began with me. There now is peace in my, whatever you can conceive of, the greater greaternessness, but there is none. So, do you understand me? And do you understand if you're going to say that, well, first, if you're going to listen to the newspaper, listen to the news, if you're going to listen to television and read the newspapers and magazines about the conflicts, then you're going to be thinking conflict. And you're going to be in the way of the progress of peace. Because you're going to be thinking conflict, and you're going to be thinking, there's a conflict there, you're at peace, you're at peace. There's a conflict there, you're at peace, you're at peace. And you just, you know, beat yourself up. You just, so dualistic that you cannot have the peace that you want. Now, when your child comes in and says, Mommy, I hurt. Well, what's the matter, sweetheart? I scratched my knee. Well, let's take a look now. And so, kiss it and make it well. And okay, now, that kiss is a healing kiss. So you're holding for right now. And out they run. I'm home for 5 months. Now, you don't say, oh dear, there might be bacteria in there. There might be, what kind of thing when you step, shut up. When you step on a nail, there's something that gets into you and stuff like that. No way, no way. It's perfect. It's perfect. It's perfect. Right?
That's right.
Right. And you start fooling around with words, you know, like, it's this here and I got to take this here and I got to get shots for that. Forget it. Take your shots. Do all these things, but you don't need it for that. You just need it to make the doctor happy. So the doctor can earn a little money on it. I mean, really, that's a good way of thinking about it. Because if you have it because you need it, then you're putting power on that situation. We need to have a peacekeeping force. Yes. And you know what the peacekeeping force is? There now is peace on earth, and it began with me. That's the peacekeeping force. When they wrote that song so many years ago, whatever their names are. It was nice, but it was traditional. Now there is peace, let there be peace on earth, and let it begin with me, and let there be peace on earth, and let it begin with you, and let it begin with you, and let it. No. Me. Now, and it's not, there is, or there will be, but it is. Now there is peace on earth, and it began with my thinking. With my attitude. You go out and your kids are having an argument in the yard and you say, well, you little son of a, I don't want to hear that kind of nonsense around here. And you go out there and you're a peacekeeper. You're not a battle general. You go out there and you say, kids, ice cream time, come on. And you say, I don't know, those monsters in my house eating ice cream. Yes, you do. You want peace. So you bring them in and then they're sitting there eating the ice cream and you say, now kids, this is a peace zone. Everyone who comes into this yard is a peaceful child who says, peace, peace, peace. And everyone who comes in this yard says, now there's peace on earth and it began with me. Can you say that with me? Come on. Now there is peace on earth and it began with me. What does it mean? It means that wherever in the world anyone is unhappy with anybody else about anything, now there is peace on earth, and they are happy with each other because they're happy with themselves. Now there's, did you ever think of that? Hey, you guys got a job to do. Up in the outer atmosphere are a bunch of little things flying around, and asteroids, and astronauts, and astronauts, and what have you. And we want to keep them in perfect balance. So let's say, now there is peace on earth, and they're all began with me, and they're all floating in perfect harmony with them. And it's a beautiful universe, a beautiful place. Yeah, can you imagine that? Now, you see, you take any circumstance and make it into a healing experience. Into a wholeness experience. And you don't have to be Jesus and God sort of stuff about it. That scares people away faster than anything. Because nobody wants Jesus in their world particularly. Nobody wants God in their world. They want themselves in their world. And that's what it's all about. When Mr. DeSwart died, he didn't say, tell Jesus that I'm leaving. He just said, thank you for holding my hand. He said, I never got to know you. You know? But you're a good boy, you know? And I said, Mr. DeSwart, you're a good man. And all your children love you very much, even though they're all out doing their own thing, you know? And he says, I kind of thought so, you know? I love them too, you know? But you see, these are all things that are said that Mrs. DeSwart heard. These are all things that were said and that were wonderful. Did I answer your question partly?
No. you answered it in total. It's just what's ironic for me personally is I do believe I create my experiences.
Yes.
And sometimes I sit and watch what's coming up next and I laugh and wondering how the heck I created this thing that's coming up.
No, ask how you're going to handle it, not when you create it.
And then the next thing is, I can also dissipate it also. If I don't want to take it on, I can dissipate it. And
if it's something
you don't. I've already gotten everything I needed from it and didn't have to walk through it. Well, I wondered about this peace thing because my MO in life is usually considered I make conflicts.
That is what people thought of you before. Now people only know you as Miss Peace. Not Peace Pilgrim, but Miss Peace. And you are a person who's, anyone who comes up to you with a conflict, you look at them and you say, peace, peace be still. Yeah, not to them, but just to yourself, peace, peace be still. So when it comes into your awareness, it's peace, peace be still. And when I talk to people who are having a problem, I say, I like me, I am divine order, I am peace. And when you lay your head on the pillow at night, only one word, just say, peace, 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 peace. You wake up in the morning, peace, peace, peace. All night long you've been saying peace. And what a lovely thing to say. What a lovely thing to say. Because that means harmony in your body, harmony with every organization function in your body, harmony in your affairs, harmony in your life, harmony in your mind, harmony and balance in your thinking. That you don't have to take calming pills, you don't have to take peace pills anymore, you know. And you don't have to take Tylenol or any of these other things to destroy pain, because you don't have pain. You are peace. Whenever a pain comes into your body, before you take any pill, stop and stop being active and just say, peace, peace, peace. Breathe out deeply. Peace, peace, peace. And pretty soon, all the pain is gone. All the pain is gone, if not instantly. And then when it's gone, stop wondering where it went. Let it be gone. Yeah. Let it be gone. Okay, anything else?
Mm-hmm.
You have. We answer a lot of questions when we don't realize we're answering them, don't we? It's beautiful. Now, did any of you have any questions at all? You certainly got a mouthful from me. And if you think this is interesting, and it is passingly interesting what I've done with you today, but I do this from 6 to 7 days straight, every day, 4 hour lectures, 4 1-hour lectures, every day, 1 3-hour lecture on why I can say I'm God, I am God, and listening to the divine within. And I have to give the talk to people so that they can know what they might expect when they're doing the 3-hour meditation. Because otherwise, when they're listening to God within, they don't know what to expect. And I tell them things that they could expect. And I said, this is just a starter. And so I do that. And I'll be doing that when I'm in Monterey in Switzerland. I'll do that down in Africa again. But every year it ends up being done 2, 3, 4 times. But people come, I want the 3-hour meditation. I want the 3-hour meditation. I said, you do. That means you get up at 2:30 every morning. You come fresh as a lily. And you come into our that. You sit on the floor on our meditation benches. You know, we have these meditation chairs. You sit down there and you go potty beforehand. And don't go doing it during the middle of it. If you have to go, you go, of course, you know. But don't. And so then I fool them. I make a slight pause in between each part so they can get up and go and do what they have to do, or at least change focus a little bit. But in the School of the Master, there was no changing focus. And I did this every single day for 3 months, the 3-hour meditation, and worked with them and had them all listening and careful. And then I would have them in the 3-hour meditation, not the 3-hour meditation, but in the School of the Masters. Another one of the things, they had to stand on one foot for a day or two or however long I asked them to stand. Can you imagine that?
No.
Stand on one foot. And hobble on one foot. If they had to do anything, go to the bathroom or anything, they had to hobble, but stay on one foot. And I would say about two-thirds of them did it. And the others gave up. And I said, hey, that's okay. You know, don't feel bad that you gave up. Just feel that you missed the greatest opportunity of your life. And finally, when I finished with them, I had them go down to the gymnasium where we have a swimming pool, indoor swimming pool, and an indoor jacuzzi, and exercise equipment and stuff. And the cover of the jacuzzi was covered. It had a cover on it. And so they all went in, and I said, okay, drop. And everyone dropped right where they were, on the tile, on the jacuzzi, and slept for a full 8 hours, just like a baby, you know. And they didn't move an inch. And here, I mean, I'm doing all these things, but I've got to be there to make sure they're okay. I've got to make sure they don't fall in the pool in their sleep and things like that, you know. So it's an exciting adventure, but it's great. Yeah. So, anything else anybody have?
So what does that cost?
I have no idea. I think it was rather modest. It was either $3,000 or $5,000 for the 3 months. Mm-hmm. That means all your meals, all your lodging, everything else, plus lessons night and day, plus being, you know, hearing the lectures, coming, talk to me whenever you need to, and we threw in the guitar and the other things, and we threw in their wedge pillow. After toward the end of the seminar, I gave a wedge pillow. You know what a wedge pillow is?
Mm-hmm.
And oh, they thought that was just so wonderful. You know?
When's the next one?
I'm not sure. It depends on when they want to set it up. I have had a lot of requests for it, but I say just check with Ellen. Check with Ellen. It's a very demanding activity for me on my time, because nobody else does anything. I have to not make the meals. I buy the food, I answer the telephone, I take care of any bills that have to be paid, and I do all the other work, and I check on each one of the people, make sure that they're doing what's right, and I have eyes in the back of my head and in front of my head and know what they're doing, and make sure that they follow the program that they set for themselves. It's a matter of self-discipline, but it's a really a fantastic program. And we had quite a few girls. We had Monica, we had Sylvia, we had Ilsa, we had Ingeborg, we had Katrina, we had Gertrude, we had, they don't all come to me right now, but I mean, that's some of the girls. And they all just had a wonderful time. And then we had all these guys too. But what a great experience. Okay, now what is our next program, if there are not any questions? Are we going someplace or doing something or what?
Yeah, we have a TV show tonight.
Oh, what time?
6:00.
6:00,
early
okay.
On.
Okay.